In his new book, What the Hell Do You Have to Lose?, civil rights historian and political analyst Juan Williams denounces Donald Trump for intentionally twisting history to fuel racial tensions for his political advantage. In Williams' lifetime, crusaders for civil rights have braved hatred, violence, and imprisonment, and in so doing, made life immeasurably better for African Americans and other marginalized groups. Remarkably, all this progress suddenly seems to have been forgotten, or worse, undone. So says Williams in his new book, What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? Juan Williams has covered and written about American politics for four decades. He's currently a columnist for The Hill and was a longtime writer and correspondent for NPR and The Washington Post. He is currently a co-host of Fox News Channel's roundtable debate show, The Five, and makes regular appearances across the network. Again, the new book is What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? Trump's War on Civil Rights. It's a great pleasure to welcome Juan Williams back to our microphones. Juan, thank you very much for being with us. Always a pleasure to speak with you.
Joe, you're so kind. Good to be with you again.
Thank you very, very much. So, of course, the title comes from something the president said, What the Hell Do You Have to Lose?, speaking to the African-American population. In wanting to write about this, it really does set the tone, because what we've learned is we have a lot to lose, don't we?
Well, I think so. And, you know, what's interesting is so many people, as you just did, say Trump was speaking to the black community. I think he was not. I think he was speaking to the white community. I think he was speaking specifically to working class white Americans, either in the distant suburbs or in rural America. And he was speaking in condescending tone, suggesting that there's such dysfunction, chaos, violence, you know, people shooting each other in record numbers in Chicago, for example, bad schools in those neighborhoods, no jobs. So what do those people have to lose by changing away from the pattern of supporting Democratic candidates and coming to him as a Republican? The thing is, of course, that Trump didn't say to those folks, I don't have any plans to help in those communities, but I am exciting you by pushing a fear button and making you worry about that chaos possibly coming towards your communities and whether those people might take your jobs or whether they might mug you. And again, I think he was speaking about only the poorest elements of the black community, not speaking about most black people who are either near or in, solidly in the middle class. And he was doing it in such a way as to excite racial tensions in American society.
You make this point very early in the book, and it's such a great point that you say he intentionally put blinders on. And you say instead of asking black people what they have to lose by voting for him, he needed to ask himself, how the hell did I miss all of this?
Well, you know, it's an interesting point because I'm 64 years old, Joe. And President Trump is 72. So I'm just 8 years younger. But as I say in the book, one key difference is I'm black. And the things that he has overlooked are the prime story of my lifetime in terms of race relations in America. Without a doubt, you look at the growth of the black middle class, as we were just saying a moment ago. Right now, it's 40% of black Americans earn between $35,000 and $100,000. Another 12% earn between $100,000 and $200,000. So what you see is that more than half of all black Americans are either in the middle class or beyond the middle class. That's an incredible achievement in my lifetime. And you can put it in terms of real people that your listeners might recognize, Joe. People like Oprah Winfrey have emerged in my lifetime. People like everyone from Michael Jackson to Kendrick Lamar in terms of rising to the top of popular culture, Denzel Washington as a movie star, you know, winning an Academy Award, Colin Powell as Secretary of State, first, of course, as head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Condoleezza Rice as a black woman Secretary of State. These are incredible accomplishments. And I, how can I forget? And President Obama, the first African-American president. These things have all taken place in our lifetime, in the president's lifetime, but he doesn't focus on the idea that, gee, you know, what an amazing moment in history to see these accomplishments take place. Instead, he focuses on the 22% of black Americans still mired in poverty and still in desperate situations, And he says that's the problem, and that's the way he identifies black people to white America, as this really crazed, violent, desperate group that's a threat to the entire society, and because of reliance on entitlement programs, about to drive up your tax bills. That's a totally negative portrayal of an entire group of people.
You start off the book by talking about voting rights, and it's such a great place to start because, as you point out at the beginning of that chapter, it was something that just days into office, the president was already tweeting about the legitimacy of the election that he won because of what he referred to as voting fraud, which eventually ended up to be nothing, of course.
Well, I mean, that's why they had to disband the commission, isn't it?
Right.
So he comes into office, and this is almost like a psychological mapping, because he comes in and he's very concerned that people are going to say that his election was illegitimate on the basis not of the Russia probe, but because Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by more than 3 million votes. And so he comes in and says, I would have won the popular vote if it wasn't for all of this fraudulent voting. And so he forms a commission led by Chris Kobach, the attorney general out in Kansas, and they go about fly-specking the country for any evidence of voter fraud. They can't find any, Joe. It didn't exist. They could not find any, and they disband the commission. But Trump has subsequently then said, hands off, as you get some Republican majority state legislatures closing polling places around the states, limiting the hours for voting, upping requirements for how people are identified as they register to vote, making registration more difficult in some cases. All of this amounts to a voter suppression effort that disproportionately impacts poor Latino and black communities. So even as he has disbanded the Voter Fraud Commission, the effort now is continuing, but it's continuing at a local level.
You write a lot about Bob Moses in that chapter. Tell us why that is such an important story for us to know.
You know, this is such an important part of the book. In every chapter, you know, the structure of the book for your listeners to appreciate is that I highlight the key provisions of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. So what you have are a chapter on voting rights, as Joe just explained, but then I go on to talk about everything from education and housing and more, so that all of these six key elements of the Voting Rights Act, public accommodations, equal rights legislation, employment, all six are touched on in a chapter. The one on voting rights, again, goes back to that period of the Civil Rights Movement, talking about Trump's attitude first, but then explaining what it took for us to get to the point where you have not only a black middle class, but you have black political voice and black political participation in this country. And key to that story is the man Bob Moses that Joe just mentioned. Bob Moses was a young man who went south working with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, to register black voters, and often at grave risk to his life. The man was beaten, jailed repeatedly, but he was in really small towns in Mississippi and Alabama, teaching people how to fill out registration forms, insisting that they take the risk to stand in line to register, even as local sheriffs would come and beat them, even as employers would fire them, local banks would try to repossess their homes for trying to register to vote, because it was seen as a threat to the white establishment in the South. But Bob Moses was the leader of so much of that effort. He was down there before Cheney, Goodman, and Schwerner, and you may remember those names because they were three civil rights workers going to register voters who were killed by the Klan and a local sheriff's department in Mississippi. And again, it was Bob Moses who picks up the baton and continues their efforts after their murder, and does so with, you know, such bravery. It's astounding that somebody like, you know, one of us Americans made such an effort on behalf of other Americans. And I just wanted to lay out that story for the reader so they'd appreciate why people are concerned about any attempt to suppress minority voting in this country.
Your first book was Eyes on the Prize, and that was a book that went along with a companion volume to the PBS series. And in which you're talking about the civil rights movement, you're talking about so many of the issues that you just described as the way that the book is laid out. Is it surreal for you to, having written that book and going into that history in such great detail, of looking at it 30 years later and realizing, yes, what you alluded to much earlier in our conversation about the things that have emerged, but also the things that haven't?
You know, I'm glad you brought this up because I was giving a speech on the book last night, and toward the end, I just mentioned, you know, it's 30 years since Eyes on the Prize was published, since the TV series aired, Joe, and the audience applauded. And I said, you know, for me, it's so incredible that a book's been in print for 30 years. But I think your point is more really cogent, because to me, it's, you know, that story was told 30 years ago about the struggles to bring black Americans into the American mainstream as fully participating citizens, full partners in our democracy. And I had expected at the time that so much of that struggle was therefore over. And of course, you know, it's 10 years since we elected the first black president in 2008. And again, there was every reason for optimism and feeling like, boy, you know, this country is just moving so forward and so quickly forward in the area of race relations. And, you know, there was always disappointment or setbacks, but you just think, you know, the general direction of the history is so positive. So to come to this moment where President Trump is calling a black woman, Omarosa, a dog in public, to come to the point where he is saying that, you know, NFL players, because they're protesting police brutality, kneeling during the anthem, are SOBs who deserve to be fired right away. When you see that he's talking about a congresswoman, Maxine Waters, as a low intelligence individual, playing, I think, on the stereotype of blacks as having low intellect, you stop and say, oh my God, how did things turn around so quickly? I mean, it seems to me like this is more than 30 years in the past. This is beyond the point when I was writing Eyes on the Prize. So it's so discouraging.
You actually, one of the comments on the book is from Donna Brazile, who says, you know, we might find the moral arc of our history suddenly bending backwards. But we're doing that, right? I mean, we're already bending backwards.
Well, in so many ways. I don't know what to say. It's sort of dispiriting, isn't it, Joe? But I mean, you know, after the Kavanaugh hearings, I think a lot of women in the country feel, you know, something's going backwards here. And I think that if you ask people in the Latino community in terms of the anger that's being expressed towards immigrants, not only in terms of the president's policies towards illegal immigration, but I'm talking about his desire. He's proposed cutting legal immigration in the country. In all these ways, what you see is someone who seems to be oriented towards pushing the clock back in time. Maybe this is a reminder that his campaign slogan was Make America Great Again. And it was, I think, referential of a time maybe in the 1950s that he sees as ideal. But I think lots of people in a more diverse America, and that's where we are today, realize that back in the 1950s there was limited opportunity for people of color and for women, and that they fear going back in time before the Brown decision, before the Civil Rights Act of 64, before Dr. King, before Thurgood Marshall, before you had people, not only Democrats like the Kennedys and President Johnson, but also Republicans. Remember, it was Eisenhower who sent the 101st Airborne into Little Rock to protect the rights of 9 children trying to attend Central High. Remember that it was Richard Nixon who, with his Philadelphia plan, was the first to talk about the need for affirmative action to help lift up and build that black middle-class community. So it's almost as if Trump is pushing the clock back in time rather than embracing the idea that America is a country that's always been about moving forward and being inclusive.
So a couple of points. One thing is, I mean, you were talking about Omarosa and what he called her and Maxine Waters and so forth. But, you know, on the first day, I mean, the day that he was inaugurated as president, he went after John Lewis, of all people, a civil rights icon. He goes after John Lewis and he says that Congressman Lewis should spend more time on fixing and helping his district, which is in horrible shape, rather than falsely complaining about the election results. All talk, no action or results, sad. That was of John Lewis. And I bring it up because we're talking about this idea of what then was referred to as the dog whistle, a term I'm sick of.
I agree.
Dog whistle. Well, we're well beyond dog whistle. There is no, the dog whistle indicates that it's something that is being done that you can't hear. Well, we're hearing it loud and clear, aren't we?
I think so. You know, again, the facts don't support what the president was saying, even if you say, oh, you know, Joe Juan, he's just, you know, punching back. He's a great counterpuncher. John Lewis criticized him, so he's going to criticize John Lewis. But the facts aren't right. John Lewis represents a prosperous area of Atlanta, which is a booming city in America. So you have to stop and think, what is he doing? I mean, in other words, he feels he can create his own set of facts in order to demean and to diminish John Lewis's standing. But again, I think, Joe, you and your listeners know John Lewis is someone who had his head cracked open, bloody, on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, again, marching for equal rights in Alabama. So he was a civil rights leader, and today, as a member of Congress, often referred to as a civil rights icon. But to President Trump, he doesn't have any respect or reverence for this man's service. In fact, at one point, he said that he didn't think Lewis was a brave man. It's unbelievable.
And again, that idea of no action. I mean, that again is just once again going into a stereotype. And so my question to you is, as you indicated a moment ago, of this idea of bending backwards, but it's also giving great strength to those feelings of racism that were bubbling under the surface, and giving them some credence and allowing them to be shared more widely than they were before. And I don't know, and I ask you, and I mean, obviously this book is a great help, but what do we do to combat that?
Well, you know, you just expressed it so clearly. And I must tell you, Joe, that your sentiment is reflected in the polls, where you have now more than half of Americans, in fact, nearly two-thirds, saying that this president has emboldened racist and white supremacists to express their views in public. So they feel comfortable with him. As you may know, David Duke has said he's our guy. And that, of course, after Charlottesville, the president was reluctant to condemn even neo-Nazis, people standing with tiki torches outside of synagogues threatening the Jewish people worshiping inside. He was reluctant. He said there were fine people on both sides. Unbelievable. So what you get is a society now, and this picks up on what we were talking about a moment ago when I did Eyes on the Prize in the late 80s. We thought we had reached a certain point. I didn't think we would ever be returning to a day when we would see neo-Nazis marching in the street. That's unbelievable to me. I didn't think we'd come to a day where David Duke and the Klan would be pointing at the president saying, "That's our guy. That's our guy." It's unbelievable. And, of course, as we were just saying ago, I never thought we'd come to the point where you would have the president of the United States saying about a civil rights leader, hero, icon like John Lewis, "He's all talk, no action." How can you say that about a guy who was at the head of a march and got his head bashed in? Talk about action, but that's Trump.
Mm. You know, I know we've talked about this before in past conversations, but I'll bring it up again because it seems timely, as it always is, I guess. But of course, a lot of this talk is coming out of the very network that you work for. A lot of the talk of that these voices that they're allowed to speak, of course, as they should be, freedom of speech, are on the Fox network. And I will just ask you of how you feel about being a part of that organization and what you feel your role is in trying in some way to level that playing field.
Well, I think that's exactly the way I think of it. I mean, you know, some of the things that are said there concern me, but I must tell you, I'm inside that bubble, trying to burst it and trying to present a different perspective. I'm on the air every day at Fox News. And I got to take my hat off to them in the sense that they know the message that I deliver. No one tries to limit or censor what I say. And as I say, I'm there quite regularly. And to me, the important thing is that there are alternate voices who are contradicting some of the extreme voices that you hear on Fox. So I am appreciative of the fact that I'm allowed that platform to speak to people who are drawn to those kinds of Trump-like messages. I mean, to me, Joe, you know, the important thing is that people get out of their bubbles and hear from other Americans and understand that other people have different perspective, different viewpoints. And you have to say, if you're tuning into Fox, you can know there's different viewpoints. Sometimes you might not like them, but guess what? You can hear the different point of view and hear it presented by people like me.
It worries me that we are all in our bubbles, that I hear it, you know, as the host of this show, I hear it all the time,
right,
that I'm only going to listen to this and I'm not going to listen to Fox and I don't, or whatever the case may be. Or from the other side of it, I would never listen to CNN or watch CNN. So what do we do about that? How do we get out of these bubbles? How do we pop that? And I mean, certainly this discourse helps, but I'm interested in overall. And this is, of course, a much larger question of how do we get out of this abyss, this divide that we have between a tribalism that we're seeing not only in this country, but patterned all across the world.
Good point, because I think a lot of that kind of tribalism now is evident not only in the U.S., but in Europe. We've seen what's going on in so many European countries. We've seen what's going on. You know, it's just sad to say. I mean, the Brexit vote in Britain. We see the fact that the Russians, when they were going after the U.S. in the 2016 election, interfering with our election, their prime strategy was to divide us in any way possible, but specifically along racial lines. They were feeding disinformation to both sides. So this gives you an idea of how dangerous this moment in history is.
Final question. How do you feel about the midterms?
Well, I mean, you know, if you look at the polls right now, it looks like there's a potential for a blue wave. That would be specifically in the House. I think there's a good chance the Democrats have to recapture the majority in the House. The question, bigger question, is the Senate. Recently, you've seen some of the big pollsters say they see the possibility that the Democrats might capture the Senate. I don't see that quite yet, because the playing field is so favorable for Republicans. They're defending very few incumbent seats, while the Democrats are defending, you know, I think it's like plus 20 seats in states that were won by President Trump in red states. So we'll see how that plays out. But I must remind you that, you know, the polls and the pollsters were the ones who thought that President Trump would lose to Hillary Clinton.
Right.
So I would just be very cautious about that. There's a history of Democrats, especially minorities and younger voters, not turning out in the midterm election. If that's the case, I think that Trump and his supporters have evidenced great energy, and then they would carry the day. And, you know, to me, that would be very upsetting, but you just have to deal with that possibility.
Of course, there's been a lot made about women and the great number of women who are running and have been brought to the fore because of the anger. Do you see the same thing? I mean, there's certainly examples of this, but do you see this happening enough to your liking of African Americans, of people of color who are coming forward and running for public office?
I think we're, you know, this is, you know, like Charles Dickens said, the best of times, the worst of times. We've been having a conversation about things going backwards. But then you stop and you look at the possibility of a Stacey Abrams, a black woman, becoming the governor of Georgia. And you say, oh, my gosh, you mean she has any chance? Well, yes, she does have a chance.
Yeah.
Or look at Andrew Gillum, a black man, mayor of Tallahassee, running for governor of Florida. And you say, well, that's not going to happen. But, no, he has a chance. You look at people like Ayanna Pressley, a council member in Boston, winning a seat now, winning the nomination, but almost certain to win a seat in Congress. Similarly, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in New York. You see women and minorities, and I could keep going across the country, coming out and expressing energy and a willingness to run and speak up in record numbers. And this is especially true, as you pointed out, Joe, for women. A record number of women running in the 2018 cycle. And we don't know exactly how it will play out on Election Day, but odds are that you're going to see a record number of women holding office in this country right in the middle of the Trump era.
The name of the new book is What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? Trump's War on Civil Rights. It is published by Public Affairs. Juan Williams, it's always a great treat to have you on the program. I thank you very much for joining us.
Joe, it's my pleasure to be with you, and thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, What the Hell Do You Have to Lose? Trump's War on Civil Rights. Juan Williams is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.